Because we have a, we're going to have a call back to the house at, was it 3 or 3:30 did they say?
3:30.
So we have to, we will have to short circuit this. And it's my understanding that we may be able to go back for a short while and then come back out, or we'll have to reschedule. But we'll try to move as quickly as we can through these, and that I would therefore like to have your assistance. Those of you who are going to testify on bills, to keep your testimony as brief as possible, and knowing the clarity to which most of you testify on bills, I'm sure that we can have your cooperation in that. So, first bill is House. Let's see. Was Representative Cease going to be here?
It's Monday, isn't it?
Okay. House Bill 52. 2552. And let me get that side of it. Judge?
Mr. Chairman, Jack Beatty, Vice Chairman, Criminal Justice Council. This is a bill proposed by the council. It affects a change in the amount that constitutes the difference between theft one, a Class C felony, and theft two, a Class A misdemeanor. The bill shifts the number in those elements of theft which are determined by the amount stolen from $200 to $500, except in the case of theft by receiving. The reason for shifting the number is that at the time the code was adopted, $200 was worth probably $600 at the present time. So this is simply restoring the proportion of that offense, proportionate amount of the offense, back to where it was when the code was adopted. The reason for excluding theft by receiving is that the council felt, and we had a lot of testimony concerning it, that the encouragement of theft itself by those who commit theft by receiving is something that ought to be penalized at the felony level. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. I assume this is that the definitions of livestock animals still stand today in this day and age.
Mr. Chairman, we were careful to avoid getting into that thicket.
I appreciate that, and I won't take you into it. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Steve Jacobson.
Steve Jacobson from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. I've submitted some written testimony in support of this bill. The content is basically the same as what Judge Beatty has just testified to. We believe that partially it's just a housekeeping measure to bring us up to date to where we were in 1971 when the new criminal code came into effect. It also will effectuate a great deal of cost savings throughout the system in treating what are really petty offenses as petty offenses, both in jail space, indigent defense costs, which is in a way against our office's interest, but we really think it should be done. Thank you.
Good. Questions? Thank you. Patrick Callahan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I was asked this morning to come down and testify on this on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm employed there, have been for 6 years. I'm currently the senior deputy in charge of the Felony Property Crimes Unit, which includes theft in the first degree. I've been asked to let the committee know that our office takes no position on this bill changing the limits. I do have a couple of suggestions for the members of the committee, and I apologize that we don't have these in written form simply because we didn't know of this hearing until this morning. First of all, I think that the committee should note the impact of the change on a large metropolitan area. In Portland, for instance, the distinction between felony and misdemeanors makes the same distinction between a crime that gets investigated by detectives and one that does not. Felonies are investigated by a detective. Misdemeanors are not. One of the concerns that our office has is if you raise the jurisdictional limit, you may be penalizing our more vulnerable citizens who are victims of crime. For instance, the elderly and infirm who might be the victim of a crime would no longer have their crimes prosecuted because they wouldn't be investigated. So I might pose to the committee the possibility of carving out an exception for the elderly or infirm along the lines of the definition that is in ORS 163.205 sub 2 for dependent persons in the criminal mistreatment. I can respond to questions on that. I would also suggest that this committee consider tightening up section 2.1c of the bill as it is before this committee, which regards theft in the first degree committed by buying, selling, or lending on the security of the property. I think it's just by omission in the prior act, it should be by buying, selling, lending, or borrowing on the security. So I would suggest that the committee add that language to punish both sides of what is in effect a pawn transaction, which is what I think this was aimed at. Punish not only the person who lends money on the security of stolen property, but also the one who borrows. I'd like to make an observation also that in the last few years we've seen quite an increase in the amount of serious embezzlement cases, swindles, large amounts of money that's involved. Those are the kind of cases that need the detective investigation that currently perhaps we're not getting, and therefore I would submit that it might be appropriate, rather than merely retaining two classes of theft. But members, if you would consider the following, and that is amending the classifications of theft as follows. Theft in the first degree should be theft in an aggregate or single transaction over $10,000 and should be made either an A or a B felony. That's to punish the serious embezzlers who at this point can only be punished with what is an expungible offense, a C felony. The next classification down would then be currently what we have now, or what is proposed by the committee, from $500 to that $10,000 limit, which would be a C felony. To gain on the other end, I would suggest that the committee consider making theft in the what would amount to be in the fourth degree, that is under $50, make it a C misdemeanor. The savings that would come out of that would be in the expenditure of resources, in that a district attorney or a prosecutor's office could make the policy decision under guidelines under the Freeland case that these could be alleged as misdemeanors, or excuse me, as attempts. An attempted C misdemeanor would then make it a violation. There would be no right to a jury trial. There would be no right to court-appointed counsel. And therefore, I suggest that the committee look at that scheme with an eye towards savings, towards punishing the more serious offenders, and towards effectively looking at the more petty offenses in just that light. That is, that they are a more petty offense and not deserving of the full range of punishment. I'm open to questions. I would also indicate that our office is fully willing to help draft, not only answer questions, but to draft any additional provisions, definition-wise, or other proposals that this council, this committee would propose that we aid them with.
Mr. Callahan, I realize that you weren't prepared to come down with written amendments. We will have potentially a work session on this, and I guess what I'd ask is if you have amendments to put those in writing.
I will do that.
And I would be, because you are suggesting some fairly significant changes.
I'd be happy to do that, and I would also be happy to attend that work session and aid in any way that I can, and anyone else in our office would be happy to come down and help.
President Springer.
When you say that the DA's office, Multnomah County, has no position, does that mean Mr. Shrunk has no position on it? I mean, I don't know the process by which your office takes positions or doesn't take positions.
I suppose there's three positions we could take. We could oppose, we could not oppose, or we can take no position. We've chosen no position. That is Mr. Shrunk's position.
In terms of the amendments you propose, I guess I'm a little surprised. Maybe you can tell me. The interim committee has been working on for the past year and a half, and I know Mr. Shrunk, like all the other DAs, have been invited to participate, and Mr. Shrunk has participated in meetings where these kinds of issues have been discussed. I know you may not be able to answer this question, but I would appreciate it if you could ask Mr. Shrunk perhaps to let us know, maybe at the next opportunity or in writing. I haven't seen him down here yet this session. I'm a little curious why he's waited until 2 months into the session to decide to propose through you some substantial amendments or to sort of get involved in this process.
Well, I can answer that in part, Representative Springer, and that is that some of these suggestions were made by myself, and I have only been aware of this pending legislation before this committee just in the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. As you, I'm sure, are aware, sometimes the people that actually put these things into operation are the last to know about the changes at the top, and I would be happy to get Mr. Shrunk's response to you directly.
Appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Bob Watson. Oops, excuse me. Didn't mean to jump out of turn. I missed a name. Steve Williams. Sorry, Mr. Watson.
Steve Williams. Representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, just briefly, I'd endorse the we endorse this bill, and I would just reflect endorse the statements of the judge and Mr. Jacobson concerning the fact that this is simply an attempt to move back the standards to where they were when the criminal code was amended in 1971. We think there'll be a good deal of savings in moving a lot of these cases from district court, well, from circuit court into district court. In addition, I can say that there'll be some savings in the appeals process and indigent defense since I work with the state public defender. We have a fair number of cases that come through that are simply theft ones. There's a lot less chance if someone's convicted of a misdemeanor that there will be an appeal out of the trial. And the cost of doing a felony appeal is greater than a misdemeanor appeal because of the cost of the transcripts, essentially.
Okay. Mr. Williams, where's your practice?
A state public defender.
Okay. I guess let's see if there are any questions first, if we may. Any questions for Mr. Williams? I'd like to ask you, or maybe your colleagues, if you could. I think one of the reasons that we've heard that this bill is here is a concern about reducing costs where it's efficient to do so, and obviously the public interest is not going to be compromised, and it suggests this is one way to do so. But I'm curious, is there any way that you, or perhaps working with the other folks who try these cases regularly and know the procedure in court, could try to maybe give us a ballpark estimate of what the difference in cost to the system is from, say, prosecuting a felony theft when we're talking about a $205 leather coat as opposed to a $195 leather coat?
I'd be happy to try and find that out through our organization and see if we can come up with some figures as to the difference between the prosecution of one case as opposed to another case.
Sure. Yeah. In terms, I know it's, there may be some assumptions in terms of plea or trial, but in terms of the court time that's required, how much it costs to operate a circuit courtroom for a day as opposed to a district courtroom, again, I know that you may have to approximate, but since we're concerned about cost, I think even rough information on that score would be helpful.
I'd be happy to get that and submit it.
Any other questions for Mr. Williams? If not, thank you very much. Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have no written testimony, but this bill moves in the direction that the jail overcrowding project has been moving for the last 2.5 years, and we're here to support the concept of the bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Watson? If not, thank you. Cy Kornbrook?
Just stepped out.
Okay. That's the last witness who signed up. We'll try to retrieve Cy if he can be retrieved here. Is there anyone else who didn't sign up who wanted to speak on 2552?
He's on parole.
He's on a
temporarily.
Yeah, close supervision out there, I think. We'll wait a moment to see if size going to be available.
Can we talk to Pat again for a minute?
Who do you want to, Mr. Callahan?
Mr. Callahan.
Okay. Mr. Callahan, if you would be so kind as to respond to a couple of questions.
Sure,
perhaps.
Thank you.
Representative Bauman?
It'd be a loss of a great opportunity if I couldn't ask you a couple questions, Mr. Callahan. First, I'm curious because on line 18 of the bill, and I don't know if you can speak to this, but you mentioned changing that to buying, selling, lending, or borrowing on the security of the property, and I'm just looking at 164.095, definition of theft by receiving. Are we redefining theft by receiving here, going to create some confusion potentially about what theft by receiving is by virtue of this, or are we just carving out a special category?
By adding the language of borrowing or lending?
I don't see
I guess
that
the,
language.
If there was, excuse me, if there's confusion, it's probably already there. Adding the language that I've suggested regarding borrowing, I don't think would confuse it anymore.
No, I agree with that.
Okay. If you're talking about is there a confusion, I think that there may be. The understanding would be that theft by receiving can be committed under the statute of 095 by obtaining, receiving, or concealing property, knowing it's the subject of theft. And there can be two degrees of that, first degree and second degree, based on the value. The legislature in the past has made the determination that it should be enhanced to a felony offense, regardless of value, if a person obtains, conceals, or withholds property, knowing it's the subject of theft, and then they sell, buy, or lend on the security of that property.
Okay.
Right?
So there's another reference to theft by receiving at another point in the statutes that I'm not referencing on other than 164.095.
Well, 164.055 defining theft in the first degree, subsection 1C is the theft, that is the theft in the it'll be a theft in the first degree if the theft is committed by receiving, committed by buying, selling, or lending. So
second, that's clear now. I appreciate that. My second question on your special group of dependent persons, it just kind of raises again the question of what standard of value we use. And I don't remember what the standard is. Do we use the replacement value, a wholesale value, a retail value?
Market value, which is In simple terms, I think we usually, it is defined in the statute, but I think for most simple purposes, it's willing seller, willing buyer. What would the market price be? For a retailer, that's easy. For you or me, if our car stereo is taken, it becomes a much more difficult. And I would add that brings up another potential problem with this bill, that we may just be making a policy decision here. One of the most common crimes we have that people are subjected to is the car clout, all right? The breaking into your car and taking your radio. Those crimes by this bill would almost in every case be a misdemeanor. There are people who do that for a living, and there would be no way that we could punish those as a felony unless they were so bold as to take a particular unit, car stereo, that is worth more than $500. Whereas now, the $200 limit, we may, in many instances, be able to punish that as a felony. But if it goes to $500, I think that you'll see very few of those people be able to be punished as a felony. Now, that's neither here nor there. You could still put them in a year in jail, quote unquote, but we all know what that means. Any other questions?
Anything else?
That's it from me.
Okay.
Thank you again, Mr.
Callahan. Any sign of sigh? We'll allow him a chance if he returns a little bit later. Anyone else on 2552? Okay, if not, we'll move on to 2553. And There are three individuals who signed up for this on behalf of OJOP, I believe. Judge Denneke and Sheriff Burks and Mr. Watson. If the three of you would like to come up together, it'd be great.
Chairman, on behalf of the jail overcrowding project, and in view of the time pressures we're under, I'll be very brief. You have written testimony from the project on House Bill 2553. There will be another bill on sentencing guidelines before this committee later today or whenever you get to it that has also to do with sentencing guidelines from the Criminal Justice Council. It's important, I think, to stress that the both the council and the criminal or jail overcrowding project believe now is the time for guidelines. And there are differences in the bill, but we hope that after these initial hearings, we can get together and move as far as possible from both groups to resolve differences. We think it's time for this approach because we need greater fairness and equity. There's a lot of disparity, we believe, in sentencing that probably is not an issue when you have enough space, but when you don't have space, it's very important that it be used wisely. We also think then it would enable a system to better manage the available jail and prison space. And not only that, but we think it's very important that the needs of the system, the resources, the space, the other staff, be known in advance, and with some system of sentencing, those needs could then be better predicted. In summary then, it's defendant similarly situated should be similarly treated. The system is not doing that now. We think it's with a better approach around the principles in the bills on sentencing guidelines that are before you that these things can be accomplished. Better planning, more facts, and with risk, which we believe the public expects from the system now, that that is a primary concern that we can move very more purposely in this area of sentencing.
Arno Denneke with the Committee on the Jail Overcrowding Project. You'll notice in both this bill and the bill that the Criminal Justice Council is submitting, we both suggest that the Criminal Justice Council or a subgroup in that council prepare the guidelines. As Mr. Watson said, I think almost everybody involved in this problem are in favor of some sort of sentencing guidelines. I talked to Judge McConville, who's sitting in the back of the room, Circuit Judge McConville. He's on a committee of the circuit judges who are also looking into the sentence guidelines. So I think there's pretty much agreement somebody should develop some sentencing guidelines.
Mr. Chairman, my name and members of the committee, my name is Dave Burks. I'm Sheriff of Lane County, a member of the OJOP committee, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We discussed this bill and others of the OJOP family, if you will, at our recent meeting last week, and we're supportive of the OJOP recommendation. We're particularly supportive of guidelines for sentencing, both for felons and misdemeanors. The sheriffs, by and large, run the jails in this state. Unfortunately, I have the dubious honor of running one of the larger ones, and 22 of us have been sued, and 19 are still under lawsuit or under court orders of some kind in the operation of our jails. And I had the opportunity to look at a printout of Tuesday of this week of our jail today, and I find the vast majority of sentenced prisoners are circuit court sentenced prisoners, which means they are felon sentenced prisoners. And what that means, of course, as I'm sure most of you know, is that the felons have backed up and down into the local jails, and the judges are using the jails for sentenced felons. And I think while it's appropriate that some of those people are incarcerated, it's displaced the district court's ability to sentence people to up to 1 year in the county jail and to handle misdemeanors in an appropriate manner. And the big load that it puts on the sheriffs is that our jails are not designed to hold long-term or 1 year and sometimes back-to-back, so you get two-year sentenced people in our facilities. We don't have the metal shops. We don't have the educational facilities and the exercise facilities just to deal with the numbers of people that we're seeing. So we're very supportive of guidelines. We would like to see guidelines for both felons and misdemeanors, because if you do one of them and not the other, Particularly if you do felons first, I think it'll guarantee that it'll be backed up into our local jails and make our local jails even less manageable. If we learn nothing else, we know that that our jail beds are very scarce resources, and we need to guarantee that they're used in the most appropriate manner. And that's what we think this bill will assist us in doing. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? I'm wondering, Bob, if you could, maybe you did this. Sorry, I was out, losing my voice. And we'll hear the Criminal Justice Council's bill on this, but would you just briefly describe the differences as you see them in the two bills?
Mr. Chairman, there, from our discussions with the members of the Criminal Justice Council, I think there are three fundamental differences. The bill that's proposed by the Jail Overcrowding Project is very specific about a purpose for sentencing. And in our, in our bill, we talk about to punish criminal offenders equitably according to the seriousness of the crime committed and the likelihood of subsequent criminal conduct. I would point out that this terminology comes out of Section 1, which starts out the primary purpose of sentencing, so would not rule out other purposes, but would be focusing the efforts of the council as they develop sentencing guidelines to keep in mind that this is a legislative intent. There are these purposes of sentencing that that are primary, that are take precedence over other reasons, and there are many. And rightfully so, there are many other purposes for sentencing. I think that come into play as defendants and different circumstances and so forth, and the nature of the crime require many other reasons to be considered. So that's the one. We specify a purpose. Second reason, I believe, is that the relates to misdemeanors. As the sheriff has indicated, the council bill, I think for good reason, because of workload and available data and the time frame involved, have focused their attention on felons. But given our purpose and the enormous crisis that jails are in with lawsuits and actually a loss of space in the last few months because of court suits, that it's, we believe it's essential that they both be addressed so we don't have one paying a penalty for the other. And the third step is, and this is a this is a fundamental problem, I think, that given the time frame crunch that they're under, we propose a really a three-step process where they develop guidelines based upon the purposes outlined in Section 1 of our bill, then match those up with what's available. And if there are sufficient resources, then those would be submitted for review by the legislature. But if they're not, then we would recommend that they're those guidelines be changed, but then you would then be aware of why they were changed, what compromises had to be made, how the guidelines were adjusted to meet what the resources dictated. So those three things, Mr. Chairman, are the fundamental differences, and there may be others that the council members could describe for you.
I suppose an obvious question would be, have you had a chance to discuss your bill with the Criminal Justice Council and see if there's some way, we obviously want to put out one bill instead of three or two or whatever, and, you know, can we find some accommodation between the two bills? If you haven't done that, I'd appreciate your opportunity to do that and bring us back.
Mr. Chairman, we are continuing our discussion. I'd agreed we'll present our bills as written, then after this hearing try to work toward
thank you. Further questions or any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Judge.
We have
you want to go, are we going to the other bills?
No,
that's all right. What was your point, Mr. Weisson? Oh, well, you want to go through all three of those bills? That's fine. Why don't you do them together?
I have one other thing, and because of the timing, our bill was submitted prior to the Attorney General's opinion about how to manage this process in some constitutional fashion. We have some amendments that align our proposal with the proposal of the council with regard to who can write the guidelines.
Representative Bellman.
I'm not aware of the Attorney General's opinion, and if you could reference that to the committee, I'm sure our counsel can make copies available to members of the committee who want them.
Yes. I think it's been distributed to you with the bill summaries and discussion, either to the council or from the jail overcrowding project. We'll make sure you get copies.
It's probably ripping around there. Everybody found that? Okay, do you want to proceed with the other two bills as long as you're up, and then we'll just do it that way?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
2554.
House Bill 2554 deals with pretrial release guidelines. This bill, the last bill on sentencing guidelines, this bill on pretrial release guidelines, and the following one on security release are all three policy matters that the Jail Overcrowding Project would like to see the legislature refer to the council for study in the next interim and return with proposals for review by the legislature. Pretrial release guidelines are a, we found in examining this matter statewide, should be better organized than how they're handled now. The
in effect, an ongoing responsibility, then you would have to go through the same process that we have gone through in creating the mechanism to handle criminal justice, or to handle the sentencing guidelines. Now, sentencing guidelines are unique because sentencing, there are elements of the executive branch and the legislative branch and judicial branch. But with if you do that, you are in effect building into the council this kind of bifurcated procedure, not just one overriding concern, but you're doing it in other matters, and I think as a matter of policy, it is questionable whether the council ought to be functioning in these, both in terms of how the council operates and in terms of the powers that that they propose to give to the council. Most of the critical decisions on pretrial release and bail release now are being made on the basis of available jail space. And I venture to say that any statewide release schedule, bail release schedule, pretrial release schedule, that could be adopted by anybody on a statewide basis would keep in jail far more people than are ever going to be let out. In Multnomah County, you remember last week or 2 weeks ago, Judge Ellis's report that they 62 out of 72 of the people who were released had failed to appear at least once, and many of them twice. So the problem isn't going to be solved at this moment simply by creating this mechanism. Secondly, if the committee is satisfied that there is a problem and it needs to be dealt with, and that it's documented, then it seems to me it has several other choices. It can direct the judicial department to set up standards for bail and release and administrate that fit with the exercise of judicial discretion and implement it administratively. Alternatively, if they want the council to investigate and make recommendations for administrative changes, as we have done in this year's report, on other matters, they can do that, or they can ask us to recommend legislation if that's necessary. But I question whether we ought to start off by just giving this to the council and starting us off down this road. Don't question that it ought to be investigated, it ought to be looked at. And this uniformity is desirable as far as we can get it. One further question I want to point out to you, and that is, I think there is a serious question whether any guidelines can employ a statistical possibility that an offender will commit a violent crime or any crime sometime in the future as a basis for pretrial preventive detention under the Oregon Constitution. And I think that you would want to be thoroughly satisfied with an opinion, at least from the Attorney General, before you set that mechanism in motion. One other factor on that, and that is that it's going to be very difficult for anybody, based on our present knowledge of the work we're doing in risk assessment itself at the parole end, to be able to acquire all of the information that you need for a, quote, validated pretrial release mechanism. When you pull somebody off the street and make the initial decision based on the crime and on how it occurred and what's the nature of the crime as to whether that individual ought to be released, you do it on the basis of what has happened, what kind of information is available on the criminal history, and a few other bits of information. You don't have something that is validated at that point to make that decision. Point out that this is purely an individual position on my part, not a council position. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Appreciate it. Representative Schreier?
Well, just kind of as a follow-up, I guess we're aware in Multnomah County and probably other jails as well around the state that have some kind of court intervention that, it's my understanding at least, that in Multnomah County, the sheriff won't even accept people for C felonies unless it's probably some fairly aggravating circumstances. And that apparently is an executive decision, or is that a judicial decision? I guess it's not, or is that a decision that's been reached by both the judicial members up in Multnomah County working with the sheriff? Presumably that kind of decision could apply to any felony. The sheriff could just say, well, we're not going to accept these folks.
My own view is that the authority present time is judicial authority. And I think that's consistently been the view in, at least during the years I was on the circuit court, and that we made decisions from time to time starting in the 1980s based on the problem that we had with the jail. And that's why ultimately we took over the position of having the presiding judge effect releases at some point when the overcrowding became overwhelming and when the sheriff was likely to go to Rocky Butte, if we still had Rocky Butte.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. Before we go immediately to 2715, we're given a copy of the AG's opinion on these other bills. And Kathleen, I'm wondering if you could, can you give us a quick gist of that?
Sure, I'll try to. Actually, I have one here, and I apologize for not. I think I sent one to the committee at some point, but the creation of the council in the first place made it obvious that it was going to raise separation of power issues whenever it tried to implement or direct any specific branch of government or several branches of government to do anything, because it's comprised of members from all three branches, and the members are appointed by the authority of all three branches of government. So when the issue of developing the sentencing guidelines came up, we asked the Attorney General, gave him during the process the language of 2715, the implementation process in that bill, to ask if that would pass constitutional muster. His opinion says basically that it deals with, there are several constitutional issues. One is the delegation of authority issue, whether the legislature can even ask the council or any other body to take on this task. And the answer to that question is yes. The proviso is that there are sufficient standards provided to the body in order to operate. The second issue is the separation of powers question, and that is beginning at page 3 of your memo, and it talks about the membership of the council. I think a point that Judge Dewey has raised here about the presence and the participation of judicial members is really the point that's addressed at page 4 of the memo, which is the exercise of governmental power that is triggered in developing the guidelines. And what the Attorney General has said basically is you have to decide which branch of government is the appropriate place for the development of guidelines, and then the members of the council who are members of that branch of government are the appropriate body to do the promulgation. The analysis of the Attorney General is that on page 5 they will tell you that this is an unexplored interface of a dual exercise problem, resolving the delegation of legislative powers to the executive branch. What they were attempting to decide was whether this was a legislative branch function or an executive branch function. The opinion, frankly, doesn't even consider that it's a judicial department function. And the AG's conclusion is that the power is one which is permissibly performed by the executive branch. So we have an opinion which binds us as an executive department agency, saying that the appropriate branch of government for development of guidelines is the executive branch. So we have structured, and the Jail Overcrowding Project has structured in their bills, a process by which the full council would participate in discussions of development of the guidelines, but the actual final passage on the guidelines, the public hearings that would be the APA hearings, would be, that body would be comprised only of executive branch members. I would add that I believe that public members of the council would also be able to participate in that function, but you would not be able to have members of the judicial branch or the legislative branch as voting members of that promulgating body, if that makes any sense at all. Basically, that's what it says.
It's these unexplored interfaces that are
exciting. Yes, right. We ran smack dab into one of those.
Are there any questions? I think we can.
Is it
I appreciate that. We'll read this and come back with questions. You have a question, Mr. Taylor?
Spogan, all the bills that are before us relating to this area, have they incorporated this opinion in them?
Yes, they have. Actually, I believe that, the Jail Overcrowding Project people have told you that they are bringing in amendments to their bills. I believe that one of them, in error, overlooked that process, and I think they're amending that. They'll bring you those amendments.
Okay,
I know they did intend, because they were part of these discussions, to...
Okay, thank you. Okay.
2715 specifically. Yeah, thank you.
Again, I'm Ann Schmidt, representing the Oregon Criminal Justice Council. We encourage your support of our House Bill 2715. The Council, during its 14 months of deliberation prior to the approval of this concept, concentrated its efforts on two main areas: the risk assessment task we were assigned by the legislature and looking at the imposition of sentencing guidelines. Judge Beatty is chair of the Committee on Sentencing, and he has a presentation to make for you now on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know what your schedule is, and I'll try to move through this very rapidly. The justification for proposing guidelines rests in the fact that there appears to be no other effective game in town. Of all of the different mechanisms that have been explored in different parts of the country for trying to deal with eliminating the correction systems through all the states, this appears to be one that offers the most promise, and one which has had 6 years of experience in Minnesota, which demonstrate that it is capable of functioning. In the last analysis, dealing with the sentencing confinement authority is a prerequisite to the rational management of this system. And if you don't have a mechanism to manage the system, building additional space or passing innumerable additional statutes dealing with what happens in the local jails and what happens to prison and what happens to probation won't do any good, because they can't be coordinated so they interface.
The council bill, 2715, is fairly simple on its face. It provides that the council develop guidelines over the next year and a half and make recommend by November 1st, 1988, guidelines for all offenses punishable by imprisonment in state prisons and for ancillary probation and revocation of probation. It directs the council to take into consideration in developing guidelines severity of the offense, criminal history of the offender, aggravating and mitigating circumstances, protection of the community, effective capacity of state prisons, and other sentencing sanctions available. These guidelines are to be submitted to the State Sentencing Guideline Sentencing Board, which consists of the executive branch members of the council. That board is to consider what's submitted to them, but make an independent judgment and adopt guidelines. Those guidelines are to be submitted to the legislature, the 1989 legislature. And the legislature then goes on, in its consideration, can amend or change or repeal any of the guidelines adopted. Finally, the bill provides that the guidelines adopted in that manner control all felony sentences imposed after their effective date. Section 6 of the bill requires the council to submit to the legislature a list of statutes which should be amended or repealed in connection with the adoption of the guidelines, together with an explanation and proposed draft legislation. Now, with respect to the comment on the method of adoption, developing guidelines is going to be an extremely technical process requiring a lot of tentative judgments, a lot of hearings, close coordination with the judicial branch, and many revisions. And we concluded that there are two ways of presenting this to the legislature and adopting guidelines. One is to simply present it in the form of a bill, and the other single bill dealing with the guidelines. The other is to have the council adopt the guidelines and then proceed to let the legislature review the total product, and if it concludes it wants to change it by statute at that time before they go into effect. And we felt that this method would avoid involving the legislature in the process of guideline construction, but leaving it free to amend and reject the guidelines in any way it saw fit, when it had a completed system before it, and all of the collateral changes that are going to be necessary to make the system work. Choice of the council is the agency. The council has representation in the development process from all of the people concerned in the operation of the system. The experience in other jurisdictions that have attempted to develop guidelines suggests that you need that kind of a broad-based group together with public membership, and the council can provide that. And the council also has on it operating people in the agencies who are responsible for making the system work, and it makes some sense to have those in one body. Now, with respect to the council bill and the jail overcrowding bill, I want to emphasize what the jail overcrowding people have already testified to, that we agree on the desirability of sentencing guidelines. We think it's essential. There are differences. We think the differences are important. And I'll mention them briefly to you now, because I think you need to be thinking about them just as we need to be thinking about them and seeing what we can work out. First, the OJOP bill limits the structure of guidelines, as I read it and the way in which the bill is framed, to severity of offense and risk of future criminal conduct. We think, first of all, that the purpose of criminal sanctions is broader than that, and that's reflected in the language we use in the opening sections of our bill. Secondly, while we think that there is ample precedent for considering past criminal history in imposing sanctions, and that tends to be a measurement of risk, a good predictor of risk, we think it is questionable constitutionally whether statistical risk assessment should be mandated as one of only two factors to be considered in sentencing. It's the same question as to whether you are going to say to somebody, you fit into a different category because the complex of behavioral characteristics that you demonstrate in a validated risk assessment model puts you in category 7 instead of category 5, even though what you've done in that particular offense and your criminal history may be identical with another fellow who gets a 5. I think that's a serious question. I think it would be risky to set up a system in which people are going to be, in which you know every element of any major criminal statute is going to be challenged, appealed, and it would, I think, be quite risky to set this up so that we run the risk way down the road of having to resentence people from 500 or 600 or 1,000 at a time. The Section 2 of the bill requires the guidelines to the OJOC bill to specify length of incarceration in local jails as well as which alternate sanction may be imposed in lieu of incarceration. We think this language is going to be unworkable. However guidelines are developed in this state, they must encourage judicial discretion to handle approximately 75% to 80% of the offenders convicted of felonies on probation subject to conditions of some kind. And it isn't remotely practical at this stage, looking down the road, to instruct a body to develop guidelines that are going to cover all of the statutory conditions of probation plus all of the others that are authorized by statute but which have not yet been thought of by judges trying to deal with the behavior of people they want to handle or think worth handling on probation. Guidelines need to guide discretion, but we do not want to limit guidelines so severely that discretion is discouraged and it becomes much easier for judges to throw up their hands and say, simplest solution is to send him to the penitentiary. Question of misdemeanors. I understand the council's, jail overcrowding project concern with jails. Rightly so. They come in and say they've got a problem. And so is the whole entire system, got a variety of problems. Their focus, naturally enough, is on what happens to jails and what can be done to shift the burden from jails. Council's concern is how does the system going to operate itself as a whole, and how are we going to be able to do the job that we are suggesting be entrusted to us in developing these guidelines. There isn't any statistical basis for creating guidelines now. There isn't likely to be within the next biennium. And I think our position is simply that we need to develop guidelines, get them working. Then we can take a look and see what can be done with local guidelines for misdemeanors. The facilities in terms of jail and alternates to incarceration are so varied in different parts of the state that it will be an extraordinarily difficult job to develop guidelines for misdemeanors, particularly when we're trying to do it for felonies the first time in this coming biennium. The council is perfectly willing to look at the problem with guidelines and see whether it's feasible to develop them for misdemeanors in the next in the biennium after we get our guidelines working. As to whether we ought to develop ideal guidelines and then develop ones that match our resources, we simply suggest we'll have our hands full developing a set of guidelines that will work with our resources, and we certainly will have recommendations if we think those resources are inadequate. Section 5 of the bill suggests that or directs the council to do research in a number of areas and how its recommendations should be presented to the legislature. We think that the council has a broad range of areas by statute to look into. If we're entrusted with the development of guidelines, we certainly, and with monitoring them from year after year, we certainly will be doing the necessary research to take care of that. But we question the advisability of mandating a number of other studies which are going to require staff, which will have a fiscal impact, particularly in connection with this bill. We think this bill ought to deal with guidelines and nothing else. Finally, with respect to precisely how the guidelines are to work as provided in Section 6 of their bill, we think it's counterproductive for the legislature to constrict the development of guidelines at this point. A number of these decisions are not going to be easy to make, and they are going to be difficult to make and decide intelligently until after we've had extensive hearings, trial drafts, and computer runs. To do the job properly, we think the council should have a broad mandate. When the council comes back with guidelines and with the other recommendations dealing with the other statutory changes that may have to be effected, then the legislature and the committees of the legislature will have the whole works in front of it and give it all the scrutiny it needs. You know that guidelines cannot go into effect. Not only it doesn't just require the statute by the legislature to pass the to affect the guidelines, which is true, but the guidelines can't possibly go into effect until all the other statutes relating to corrections, many of them, are changed after they've been carefully thought out, passed as bills by the legislature in coordination. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, of course, what you have before you are two sentencing bills that have come from two groups that have worked very diligently representing the perspectives of the system that they have been asked to represent. I want to reiterate what Bob Watson told you earlier. The two legislative committees of the two groups are in discussion, have been, and will be, and we will keep you apprised of the outcome of those discussions.
Good. I would have asked committee council to establish some dates when we can be move on these, because I want to try to move them right along. There's another significant difference, I think, between the two bills. That is, yours asks for an appropriation, and the other one does not. I would assume that they would assume that you'd have to ask for that appropriation, and I'm wondering about a subsequent referral.
Yes, we that should have required. A subsequent referral on any of these bills and have a fiscal impact, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I didn't know if you'd already secured your funding, or whether we had to go down and do that.
Okay. Representative Burton. OJOP has a meeting scheduled on the 20th. We have one on the 25th. I assume they would concur that if you could postpone the work session until after the 25th, that would be helpful to both of us.
Okay, I'd perhaps like to sit in on a meeting with you at that time. You let me know when that meeting is, and we can work that through, hopefully. Any questions? Thank you very much for the question.
Thank you.
Judge Dewey. Sorry. Mike. You may not want that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. My testimony is essentially the same. I understand the constitutional constraints in terms of separation of powers and the Attorney General's opinion, or at least I think I do. The problem still is that the judges are going to will be on the line when they make the final decision. And this is a piece of legislation, 2715, that has the Criminal Justice Council making the decisions regarding the development of sentencing guidelines. And we would hope that you would consider a legislation that would provide that there be more than one circuit court judge that would help make those decisions, or at least there would be an advisory committee that would have that opportunity, because they are going to play a very important role in the final decision. That is my testimony, sir.
Have you had a chance to look at the Attorney General's opinion?
I have not.
Okay, you might ask committee administrator for a copy of that.
I will get a copy of that.
Take a look at that. Are there questions?
Thank you
very much. Snyder left, so Cy?
Cy Cornville, Federation of Oregon Probation Officers. I will not repeat philosophical objections to the bill. There is one particular thing that really bothers me in this. In Section 2, the guidelines shall regulate placement on and revocation of probation. I would assume the guidelines would regulate placement on probation, because that's part of the idea of sentencing guidelines. the revocation of probation really bothers me. Here, you are going to have a guideline, presumably that will be able to be read by everybody on probation, who will know immediately upon reading it what they can violate and what they can't violate based on the guidelines. You will not need a probation officer to make a recommendation because you can just tote up the guidelines. So what you can do at this point is get rid of probation and have people for job development and monitor programs, and you've removed the human element completely, and we now are able to operate in a sanitized vacuum, and I find that very disturbing in this bill.
Okay, Representative Springer?
Well, Cy, I don't pretend to have the kind of hands-on experience that you and your colleagues do, but you know, it seems to me from some testimony we've had, there are already guidelines from the parole board in terms of parole revocation, and that's basically they're not going to revoke unless someone's committed a new crime. Now, that doesn't limit the exercise of discretion of your parole or probation officers if, in fact, they feel someone needs to be hauled in front of a judge. I assume that we're not talking about limiting their ability to request an order to show cause or request a warrant, but, I mean, don't we basically have some unwritten guidelines that basically very much curtail the ability of a court or the, you know, the circumstances in which a person's going to be revoked now?
However, Representative Springer, those are not followed when the officer makes a cogent reason for not following. And that happens. We have cases, you know, it's the old thing that if there's just to give you examples, a recent study Corrections did, 72% of the people who are convicted of a crime before age 17 fail on probation. Of course, 28% don't. So if you can make a cogent reason why that person should be in that 28%, that's a reason for keeping them on probation. If you can make a reason before judges why somebody should be revoked, although the behavior in general is not the kind that would revoke, but in the specific case, because of factors, because of attitude, because of intangibles in it, very often they will. And the same thing, I will say that about the parole board. The parole board will look at cases on an individual basis, regardless of the fact that you have to be convicted of a felony. You don't. I have had cases revoked with fair regularity who have not been convicted of felonies but have violated terms of probation, because those very terms that they violated were indicative of some other behavior coupled with the person's attitude, personality, and behavior.